Hello and welcome to the Oxygen Addict podcast. We're brought to you every week by our sponsors, precisionfuelandhydration.com. You can personalize your fueling and hydration strategy so you perform at your best with 15% off your first order of electrolytes and carbohydrate fuel with the code OXYGEN24 at precisionfuelandhydration.com. Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm your host, Coach Rob Wilby. And every week we bring you an episode of this podcast to help motivate and inspire you. Couple of quick things you could do for us, please. If you do enjoy this episode, please consider following us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And please click like and subscribe if you're watching on YouTube. That really helps more than you can imagine. It helps the growth of the show and it helps more people see our videos. Secondly, if you're looking for help and advice with your triathlon training, please get in touch. You can email us at help@oxygenaddict.com or there's a link in the show notes. On this week's episode, we're joined by Andy Blow and Emily Arrell from Precision Fuel and Hydration. We'll be talking fueling, hydration and electrolytes for 70.3 and Ironman. We'll be looking at some of the case studies from elite athletes. So with that, I'd like to welcome you both onto the show. How are you both doing?
Really good, thanks, Rob.
Yeah, good, good.
It's great to have you both on again. So it's a great opportunity for us to have you on. I know the science of nutrition is moving on year by year. And we were just talking before we recorded today about how guidelines for endurance athletes have shifted massively just over the last few years around both electrolytes, fueling and carbohydrate intake. So I want the listener today to leave with a really good idea of some sort of baseline numbers that they can take away and start thinking about it. But more than anything, I want the listeners to have it raised in the consciousness that there's more to 70.3 in Ironman than just training, turning up on race day and racing. The hydration, the electrolytes and the nutrition part of it is a really big part of it. And with the athletes we coach, it's really heartbreaking when we see a situation where an athlete who's done the hard work and done the training and then it's something external that could be controlled, like the amount they eat or like the amount they drink, is the thing that takes them apart. So I thought a really good place to kick off today, let's start with an introduction to you two. Andy, do you want to give us a little quick background on you and Precision Fuel and Hydration as a company?
Yeah, well, as you know, Rob, we've chatted a few times around the backstory. For those who don't know, you know, I was an elite triathlete many years ago. And so I also studied sport and exercise science, but what led me to take a really deep interest in fueling and hydration was really cocking it up in a lot of big races, really. I went to Hawaii, which was a goal of mine, as it is for many age group triathletes, and screwed it up because I didn't understand about how much I needed to drink. I didn't know enough about my own physiology. I have a hugely high sweat rate. I lose tons of electrolytes. I wasn't replacing enough, and it was without putting too fine a point on it, it was ruining a lot of races for me that made me then say, right, I've got to do something about this. And I got into looking at sweat testing, got sweat test done, and all of that essentially led to me eventually forming the company that's now Precision Fuel and Hydration. And that is now over 10, 11 years ago. I think we first chatted probably when we were only literally 2-3 years into the business. And I know that you had a similar story with heavy electrolyte loss and, you know, kind of the sweat test that we offer really was a bit of a game changer for you. And yeah, it's been a fantastic evolution over the last, you know, 12 years to see, to move from the purely looking at the hydration kind of things to more recently looking at the fueling, and then also expanding our team, bringing in more up-to-date expertise, because I did a sports science degree back in the late 1990s and did her sports science degree in the not that long ago, so her information is a lot more up-to-date than mine.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking to realize, isn't it, that it's 30 odd years since you've been at university. Things have moved on a bit since then.
Definitely, yeah.
Emily, tell us a little bit about your sports science background then and the role that you've been playing within Precision Fuel and Hydration with the case studies, because when you sent the information through to me, I looked at it and I was like, oh man, there's hundreds of studies here into the races that people have done. And it's amazing to see this data at scale. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as Andy said, he did sport and exercise science at the University of Bath quite a long time ago now. And I just did it a few years ago. And I did placement while doing my degree. So that's like halfway through you go and do a work placement. And I luckily kind of reached out to the guys and got a place here as an intern. And then now I've joined the team full time after I finished my degree. But while I was an intern and then in the years prior to that and after that, I developed our case studies. So that I kind of built that whole process up, the back end of it that you don't see. So there's lots of spreadsheets that go into it and the calculations. We can talk about what the case studies are, but basically working one-to-one with athletes to work out their numbers. So on race day, exactly what they ate and drank in terms of carbohydrates per hour, milliliters of fluid per hour, and milligrams of sodium per liter. So we go away and I sit down with them, talk exactly through what they ate and drank, then I'll produce those numbers and a bit of an analysis and tell them where it sits with the science and the general recommendations. And then since I kind of built that process, we've got over 400 in there now. And over 200 of those specifically triathlon ones.
And to add to that, Ron, or sort of like bring it into context, I think what you as a coach, you guys as coaches will know that when you get feedback from athletes after races, some of it is subjective and some of it's objective. So you get power files, heart rate files and objective stuff you can look at to see how they've executed the race plan based on what you decided their fitness level can cover. We found that feedback on the nutrition side from races with athletes was always basically 100% subjective. And what Evan's done by drilling into the numbers and getting accurate assessments from athletes of what they've eaten and drunk and built these spreadsheets with lots of different products in there to break down the macro nutrients in them is to put a very strong level of objectivity behind not only an individual's case study from what they've eaten and drunk in a race, so you can relate it back to their performance and look at how it might improve in the future. But now we've got 200 triathlon studies and 400 overall. There's a value in that kind of aggregate data because we can look at trends and we can look at how things are moving. So it's kind of putting objectivity into something that was very, or data into something that was very subjective before. The last thing I'll say about Emily before I shut up as well is, you know, when they say, it was always said to me when I started a business, you know, what you need to do is find and employ people who are better than you at doing certain things. That's this person right here. Because we came in with this idea, and I used to sit down and do a lot of case studies with athletes, but systematizing it, making it into a process, making it into a database, and actually, you know, putting it into this like incredible resource that we have now is all there. And it's been a fantastic, you know, it's been a fantastic win for the company as a result.
Oh, that's a nice thing to say. I've heard the same thing about Emily from Chris when I was talking to him. So you've obviously come highly recommended and you're doing the right stuff somewhere, Emily. I feel exactly the same way about Chris, if it's any kind of backup. You find someone smarter than you and you employ him as quickly as you can.
Absolute liar, Rob. I don't like it. I found that point really interesting. And I think, Andy, you said it really well in terms of fitness not necessarily being the defining point of a successful race or not. And Rob, I'm sure you've had hundreds if not thousands of conversations at this point in your coaching career where actually an athlete's coming to you saying, I've done my big A race of the year and this is why I did or didn't get to my objective. And usually it's, I didn't get to my objective not because of fitness but because of A, B and C, and that is usually linked to either hydration or nutrition along the way. And it's so frustrating as a coach that we do 6 months, 10 months, 12 months of building a really solid plan and the athlete invests all their time into delivering that plan. And then on race day, because they haven't looked under the stone of nutrition and hydration and pacing alongside that, so many times an athlete blows up and it's just so frustrating. So I'm really keen to hear Andy and Emily's opinion on that, because we've just got so many athletes who are aiming for their A race and they're working really hard right now. I think now's the time, you know, we're in mid-January, now's the time to start creating a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, depending on the kind of event you're doing. And I'm sure this is something that you guys have looked into in the past, is how the hell do you train your body to get the hydration and nutrition on board? And, you know, there's so many guidelines out there that you can find on the internet of you need X amount per hour, but actually you can't just do that on race day. And so this is my first question to you as a leading question, is do you guys have a rough guideline, a rough idea of how long it takes for the average age group athlete to actually train their gut to be able to not only consume, but absorb and process the nutrition and hydration to make sure that on race day it's optimal?
Yeah, definitely. I think there was a lot to digest there, and you're absolutely right. A lot of the time, the people coming to us and the athletes that I'm getting on customer calls with, they're coming because they've come across an issue and they've had their race and they've had an issue, and then they want to kind of go backwards. But what you really want is to plan ahead and train your gut, build the whole strategy up, the hydration and the fueling. And now is the perfect time, kind of starting the year off. You've got your races scheduled and you can build up to them, depending on what they are. So in terms of active gut training and a bit of a protocol, the science says roughly 8 to 10 weeks to kind of train your gut and build up. But it depends on the individual, their starting point, and also their end goal, what the numbers that they're aiming for are. Because if you're going for something low, if you're going for 60, it might be easier for you if you're already on about 45 to build up compared to someone who's going and aiming for a bit higher. But the numbers that you're aiming for depend on the rates, yourself, and mainly the duration and intensity. And we kind of have on the back end a bit of online fuel and hydration planner where athletes can go and put in the data of their exact race, some individual traits and about their sweat rate, bits and pieces like that. And then it spits out the numbers that we recommend for that specific race. So the carbohydrate numbers that you should be aiming for, and say about 60, then what you need to go and do is see what level you can tolerate at the moment. And then when the race is coming up, that 8 to 10 week period, build up slowly week on week.
We usually recommend, Chris, that you use the sort of big brick sessions or simulation. Your longest rides, your longest runs are obviously the time to practice fueling and hydration. And to sort of go back to your point about a lot of people not really doing this, I think there's a lot of reasons why that could be. Look, a huge one is the fact that even if you train for an Ironman, let's say a lot of the time in run-of-the-mill training, maybe your longest ride's like 3 or 4 hours. You know, as a routine, you're going to go a bit longer in some of your longest rides towards the event, but you're often training at a level where you can get away with slightly sloppy practices in fuel and hydration. So training doesn't often force the point of getting your nutrition absolutely on point, whereas race day does. And from a coach's perspective or from an advisor's perspective, the idea is just to kind of force the issue a little bit early and say, yeah, you're doing a 15-mile run. You can probably do that on very little fuel and relatively little hydration if it's cold. But what I want you to do is start fueling 20 minutes into that one and fuel it like it is the Ironman run, because that's the only way you're going to get test how your body is going to deal with that. So it's moving the fuel and hydration concept up the ladder of importance when it comes to race preparation.
That's really interesting. Mm-hmm. And as a starting point for the athletes listening, would you suggest that a very rough guideline again is starting point of 1 gram of carb per body weight in terms of kilograms, or actually that's fairly old school science and things have moved on?
In terms of the recommendations during events, it's less so much focused on body weight now, and it is more looking at the grams of carb per hour, and that varies depending on duration and intensity of the event, instead of just saying, this is you weigh this much, so you need to always aim for this amount. If you're going at a lower intensity, then the carb recommendations would be lower. If you're working at a really high relative intensity for a long duration, then they'll be a bit higher. So it's a bit more individual and depending on what the actual event is that they're doing as well.
That's where, to Anna's point, kind of the fuel and hydration planner that we built on the site is a shortcut to that, because you can put in your details about the racing. It will give you a guideline target, which is heavily individualized to you and the race that you're aiming for. I think then what you need to be aware of is looking at how you scale that in your training sessions, because you can only, if for example, the upper end of our recommendations tend to sit around 90 grams of carbohydrate an hour, even though we'll talk about this later, even though we see professional and elite athletes going beyond that, 90 grams are still a lot, and it's a lot more than the vast majority of age group athletes are either taking or might need. If it spits out a high recommendation like that, it doesn't suddenly mean you're going to try and start aspiring to take milligrams of carb in all your training sessions. What that's doing is anchoring a bit of an aspiration target for what you might want to hit in the race. And I think actually the individual starting point has to be individualized to an extent around what are you habitually doing at the moment. Because it's no good saying to everyone, you're going to start at 45 and then build up, because some people are only doing 60, but some people are only doing 20. So you've got to kind of start with where you're comfortable and then migrate in the direction of where you need to be. And to Emma's point, intensity is everything. We were lucky enough to be on a training camp last week in Spain with Lotto and Destiny, the cycling team. And we followed them around on numerous training rides. The longest one we did was 200K, but that was a relatively steady aerobic ride for the guys. And pretty much universally, they were taking 50 to 70 grams of carbohydrate an hour, depending on their individual preference. But we saw them also do one long, hard ride with very, very explosive intervals, where some of them were taking 120 grams of carbs an hour because they were looking to maximize carb availability so they could really produce peak power on these climbing efforts that they were doing. So they go from like effectively half to kind of double dosing carbs entirely based around the duration and intensity of a specific training ride. What was super interesting though, per your point about athletes knowing their numbers or not, to a man, every rider in that auto count knew exactly what they needed to be taking in for racing, and they knew what their specific targets were for every single training session of that count, because it's been educated into them by the sports science and nutrition team there, and it's part of their day-to-day vocabulary. We saw it in practice, and it was very impressive. It was really impressive to watch.
Yeah, there's an interesting point here in that range of 60 to 90 grams of carbs per hour for athletes. If we look at that as a range, we've always said to our athletes, look, let's take a gram per kilo as like a baseline number. And you very quickly then, the athlete gets a feel for, well, either that's loads more than I'm currently taking, or it's about right, or it's loads less than I'm currently taking. And they can get that feel for where they are. I think the thing that's really surprised me is having a look at your case studies and seeing just how far the professionals are now pushing that further up. And I'm wondering what the effect on age group triathlon is going to be at the very highest end when this starts to catch on in the age group field as well. I think we've got to be careful in the podcast that I'll sort of highlight to the listener now. We'll talk through the examples of the elites, but I think it's worth stressing that these are the men and women who are at the very top of the game working at the highest intensity. And we shouldn't necessarily hear, well, I heard this number, so I should shoot for this number. I think your underlying message so far has been really clear in that it's individual, and then we're going to try and gradually raise the amount that you can absorb across a period of time. And as long as we work within that framework, then listeners are going to have a very clear idea. Because the last thing I want is a middle of the pack age group going out and thinking we're going to go and try 120 grams an hour off, because we know what'll happen. It'll be the same thing that happened to us. They're going to be in a port-a-loo in 5 minutes time. So that being said, Emily, talk us through what you've seen in your case studies. You've had over 200 elite male and female Ironman and 70.3 studies done. Talk us through what the numbers were in those then, both in terms of carbs, fluid and electrolyte intake.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much data in there. As you said, it's a big database now. So over 200 triathlon ones. It's about 100 full distance and 120 middle distance. So a lot, and also good because we can make comparisons between the two. Like you said, on the carbohydrate side of things and the fueling, it does show that those at the top end, so we're working with a lot of pros and high level amateurs, I think are really high numbers of carbs. So the average across all our triathlon case studies is about 80 grams per hour, but that includes the swim time as well. So really that's a really high amount of carbohydrates. And that is sitting over 100 grams per hour on the bike and dropping down on the run. The biggest difference between full and middle then is that drop off from the bike to the run. Obviously with the shorter run in middle, we're seeing a much greater drop off of close to kind of 30 to 40% compared to full distance, where you see less of a drop off, and now a trend that's increasing. It's seeing some of our pros can consistently take a high amount over the run as well. Obviously, for such a long run, keep at that high intensity for that duration and take on, yeah, really high levels. Still dropping off a bit, but just nowhere near as much as the middle distance. And then, kind of differently for the hydration side of things, it's a lot more individual. So when we're looking at the trends, there's a much greater range, whereas carbohydrates is a range. Not so much as big as the individual difference in hydration. So when we look at our fluid, it really varies depending on the individual and also on the environmental conditions. But it ranges anywhere from about 200 mil per hour, for example, up to 2 liters per hour in kind of extreme conditions and extreme cases where people have really high sweat rates. We do have some kind of outliers in there as well. And the same in terms of sodium, then it's very individual and everyone loses a different amount of their sweat. So we see a similar range of about 200 milligrams per liter all the way up to 2000 milligrams per liter. But what's really interesting is looking at the averages, obviously there is a big range, but with the sodium side of things, which is quite an interesting stat in our database, is from all of the sweat testing we've done over the last 10, 11 years, the average sweat sodium concentration sits about 950 milligrams per liter. And if you look at all of our case studies, the average relative sodium concentration people are taking on is really similar, about 940. So people are replacing their losses, but it is a lot more individual on that side of things. When looking at our case studies, you can kind of filter by someone's sweat sodium losses if they're high, moderate, or low. I think that's one of the good kind of benefits. If you can look for people similar to yourselves and see the kind of sodium numbers they're hitting.
Right. So this is something that's interesting, actually, that I hadn't realized. Athletes can actually go to your website and can look at these case studies and find people like them and see what their losses were, what their intake was, things like that, can they? They can actually look at your database.
Yeah, you can filter and find similar ones to you and also similar events. If people are doing the same events, we've got loads in there and a range of races that will be similar to the ones that your athletes are doing. And not so much so they can go and find one and copy the strategy exactly, but so they can see, one, the logistics of actually, okay, this person hit this amount of carbohydrate, how did they do it? As a bit of kind of inspiration when they're putting their strategy together, but also in terms of their individual losses, see how they met theirs. If they're a really high sweater, they've got a high sweat rate and high sweat sodium losses, for example, and that's similar to yourself, you can look at and see, one, how they did it, and two, the actual numbers they were able to achieve. And there's also a bit of kind of a write-up and a bit of science in each of the case studies that explains if they did it well, if they didn't do it well. Most of these case studies, they've done it relatively well and they're kind of success stories, but it's good to have a look and see where they sit with the science as well, which is in those case studies.
I was actually really lucky, and I think your whole team, a big thank you, because I did one of the case studies with you in 2021, and it wasn't triathlon related. It was at the Gravel National Champs. And I found it so useful. I found it so useful to actually go through the process with you of self-reflecting, because I felt at the time that I had the knowledge, and that's one thing, but actually applied knowledge and applying it on race day is very different when your average heart rate is around 190. Your thought process is very, very different. I encourage anyone to go and have a look at that database, because I've had a bit of a skim, and it's so reassuring to see whether they're elite age groupers or, you know, some of the best athletes in the world. They too make mistakes, and you can learn from those mistakes and you can see their progression. Some of the athletes have done multiple seasons, and you can see how their carb intake has increased, and they're not massive jumps, which I think is also something the athletes can take away. And Andy, you said it earlier, just because we're talking about, call it 90 grams of carbs as an average, that doesn't mean you go from 50 to 90 in one season. That's a big body of work and takes a lot of time to actually absorb it. One thing that was really helpful when I went through that process with you, Emily, was in my triathlon days, which was a majority Ironman distance, I was on an average around 60 grams of carbs for the Ironman distance, which, looking back now, I think was slightly on the low end. To give listeners an idea, I'm about 60 kilograms, give or take. And I know we're trying to move away slightly from body weight being the main metric. But it's interesting now in 2021, when I had that conversation with you, I averaged 70 grams of carbs, which was for a very different event. That was around 2 hours, I think. And my body weight was about the same. And I remember you saying, actually, that's good, kind of thumbs up, but it's work in progress. Whereas in my mind during that conversation, I was like, I can't wait to show Emily this. I've hit my goal. I've increased it by 10 grams of carbs. And actually, it's still work in progress. And when I look back at last season, I actually successfully hit 90 to 100 for all my races without any negative effects. So again, it just shows over 3, 4, maybe even 5 years, you can increase it without having negative effects. But like anything we do in endurance sport, it's one step at a time without going for the kind of optimal goal within a very short period of time.
Definitely. And there's loads of examples of that in our case study database. One really good one is Leon Chevalier. We've worked with him closely for 2-3 years now. And back when we first started doing case studies, really, we did Ironman Bolton in 2021, and he hit 79 grams of carbohydrate overall. Still an impressive number, and that was kind of our starting point. And then 2 years later, we've done loads of case studies. He's really refining his whole strategy. Part of that is his gut training that he's done over the two-year period. And I think at his last race, he was hitting around 116 grams per hour. So he's gone from 79 upwards even more. And that doesn't mean everyone needs to go out and hit 116 grams per hour, but it shows that over a two-year period, he's really trained his gut to build up to that 116. And there's a really nice, looking at all of his case studies, like a trend. You can see it incrementally going up over that two-year period.
And Leon's been very dedicated about practicing that in training and in his minor races. You know, he's very diligent about that. I've seen his home training setup where he does a lot of long rides and long efforts on the trainer, and he's got a little cabinet there with all his nutrition in, so he's got easy access to it. And there's none of these kind of organizational logistical barriers to getting it right. He's like you would hope and expect, I guess, from someone who is professional, making their living doing it. It's definitely part of his routine. And as Em said, from his first long distance race to his most recent one, or actually not quite his most recent one, the one prior to that, where he was fifth at the World Championships in Nice, there's just like a linear improvement. And we're probably reaching a point with Leon where it's getting close to being optimized now. So actually you wouldn't be looking for that trend to necessarily just keep continuing on. But if he can reach that, if he can reach a happy ceiling of where he's at, then he should. It kind of feels to us, I suppose, like that with Leon now, it's a very low stress conversation about planning his intake for the next race, because he's got so much data to work off. The main variable we're looking at is either the distance of the rest change, or are there any dramatic changes in the weather conditions? Like, are we going from hot and humid to very cold and dry or something like that, which might measurably affect the amount of fluid and sodium he needs, but otherwise it's fairly dialed in.
From a listener's point of view, if they are going to do a race that's going to be much hotter than the weather that they've experienced in training, are there any kind of guidelines you can give them other than you're going to need more sodium and you're going to need more fluid? Because a real big challenge a lot of our athletes have is they train in the UK and then they'll go abroad to do the big race to, you know, Austria, Germany, and all of a sudden the weather's 30 degrees on race day when it's been 15 in training. Are there any sort of guidelines people can take away from that?
It's a tricky one, because as well as everyone's sweat rate being different, the kind of range of people's sweat rate is different. So me and Andy going from kind of the UK to Kona, for example, our sweat rates would increase at different amounts. So it's hard to kind of give a scale factor, for example, and say everyone needs to drink X amount more because everyone's losing X amount more. One thing that would be helpful is people to have a good record of their sweat rate. You can collect data to measure your sweat rate. We can talk about how to do that, but it's weighing yourself before and after sessions. And what you want to do is over time build up a database in a range of conditions. So hopefully you'd have some of that in warmer conditions, some indoor sessions, for example, or some when you've gone out through a race in warmer conditions around that, if you can, so you know how high your sweat rate can get and how low it can get. And you can build up a big database to see that range, see your average, so that when you're going for a race in X temperatures, okay, my sweat rate's going to be this amount, so you can plan your fluid and sodium intake accordingly.
As a concrete example of that, Rob, probably one of the best athletes that we work with on that specific topic would be Alan Hovler, who's won the Norseman a number of times. And Alan's an interesting case study because he's quite a salty sweater and has a fairly high sweat rate. But also, a lot of Ironman races, the typical Ironman race takes place in at least warm to hot conditions. So our data set is quite limited to sort of like stuff that happens above 15 degrees Celsius and often above 20 degrees Celsius. Alan races Norseman and other races in Scandinavia where the temperature can be very low, single digits or even freezing. So he's got this massive experience and range of data on his sweat rates in different conditions. And so he can definitely go into any given race knowing really, really well what level of sweat loss per hour he can expect to experience in X or Y conditions, because he's measured himself a number of times, and then make a very strong prediction on what he might need to drink per hour to limit his losses. it's the same with the guys on the Lotto training camp. I was quizzing them about their hydration, and most of them, so they tend to operate because they get given bottles from the team car, and the bottles are about 500 to 600 milliliters, depending on how full they're topped up. They'll operate on a kind of one bottle, two bottles, or three bottles per hour basis. And they're quite focused on limiting their body weight losses after a ride or a race or a session to within 2 or 3%. And most of them then, because they measure it regularly, they just kind of know today is like a two bottles an hour day because it's pretty hot and humid and we're going to be working hard. Whereas on another day, it'll be like, oh, I'm just going to, on that long, easy ride, I went out with them. Most of them were on one bottle an hour and they were making up their calorie deficit with gels instead because the weather was also cool that day. So it's not a sort of a shortcut answer or a quick and dirty answer, but it's about really understanding how your body responds in different conditions. And the biggest metric that you can measure is loss of body weight and trying to limit that loss of body weight to within a sensible proportion. For most people, that's staying within 2 or 3% of what your starting weight was. Some people might be able to stretch it out to 4 or 5%. And on the flip side, you don't want to be maintaining weight or even gaining weight because that's an indication that you're drinking too much. And you know, a few weeks or months of collecting data and practicing that, you get a really solid idea of what you should be doing.
So it really comes back to athletes starting to collect this data, keeping a track of how much they drink, their electrolyte intake and their carbohydrate intake on the rides, and then keeping those records and seeing how it changes for them over time, right?
Bully, if you could get this number from your Garmin or your phone or whatever, we'd all be way, way better at doing this because we've all adopted all these other data metrics. Like I measure my HRV now because it's convenient and easy to do so. And I would say I'm ruled by it, but I sort of take notice of it sometimes. If it's going in the wrong direction, I'm feeling a bit shit, I'll change my training or whatever. Same with the pace and that. It's like, it's so many years since I've not really been out and measured my pace on the run. As you take it for granted that you adjust what you're doing based on all this data. The mindset change for athletes around this body weight stuff is that we don't currently have technology which makes it super easy. You can't just press go on your watch and when you come back, it'll tell you how much you sweated and therefore how much you need to replace. So there are wearable sweat sensors being worked on. There's technology that's kind of moving in this space. But at the moment, it falls back to being a fairly laborious and manual job. And therefore, kind of something that only those that are willing to go the extra mile do. But I think people listening to this can take it from us that, you know, we're fortunate to work with some of the very best athletes in the world. And I'm not even going to pretend for a minute that all of them do it. But an increasing proportion of these people are doing this and finding ways to make it into their routine because, you know, they're all after those gains.
As we're all talking, and it's pretty evident that there is a universal shift towards, got to be careful with what I say here, but the rule of more carbs helping performance as a general rule. And I'm trying to work out why. And in my head, I kind of feel that it's twofold. One is the science is suggesting the more you can take on board and actually absorb, the better over time. But also, I think that the products available have changed massively over even my 10 years within endurance sport. And I remember in the early years, so 8, 9, 10 years ago, there was basically one or two gels that I could tolerate. And they were disgusting. I could tolerate them because they didn't give me GI issues. But the taste of them was so terrible that actually it was very rare that I'd be taking two gels an hour if I was aiming for 60 grams of carbs. Whereas now the menu's so wide, and I'd like to think that the majority of athletes can find a taste they can take on hour after hour, but also avoid the GI issues. And this leads me to my next question to you guys, which is along the lines of, are all carbs equal? So if we're looking at, say, trying to take on 30 grams of carbs within a half hour window, does it make a difference whether we're going down the gel route, down the drink mix route, or down a choose route, for example?
Yeah, it's a good question, because with carbohydrates, there's also different types of carbohydrates. So you know, when people talk about glucose, fructose, stuff like that. And then you've got different types of products as well. The actual type of carbohydrate does matter. So when people talk about like ratios of carbohydrate, the 2-to-1 and things like that in different products, the science has shown, and that's why all the products are likely 2-to-1. To get 90, for example, 60 of that would be glucose and 30 fructose to be able to absorb that all in an hour. And that's kind of something that's progressed as the science developed. We used to think the kind of limit was 60. Now we put it at 90. Now we're seeing people being able to tolerate more. But really that, so that does matter. The type of product, on the other hand, so the gels, the chews, the drink mix, the science says doesn't make a huge difference in terms of the amount that you can digest. But obviously it depends a lot on the circumstances of the race, the actual logistics of the race. For example, the one you did, was I right in thinking that you used a lot of drink mix? Because obviously you don't have your hands off the bike, right? So you can't really open chews, for example. So the logistics play a big part in the type of carb product.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the main takeaways that I took from that conversation, is that I kept with the drink mix because I just found it so easy to take under high stress. But I changed my method, which was instead of bottles on the frame, it now goes on a hydration pack, which at times feels silly, but I literally can't take my hands off the bars for safety reasons off-road. So that was a massive takeaway. So in terms of 70.3 and Ironman, we referenced earlier in this conversation that the run is kind of the highest demand in terms of fuel needed, but it's also maybe the hardest. Logistically, it's pretty hard, but also in terms of absorption rates, I'm assuming that that's the most challenging phase of the triathlon. If that's the case, do you guys have any recommendations for athletes listening of how you can adapt what you take on the bike and what you do on the run? Or are you guys saying whatever works on the bike usually works on the run? So that's your starting point. Try that in training and then play around with it. Or do you have some set rules that you can guide us towards?
The logistics of running, as you said, make it much harder to take on the kind of same amount of carbs that we see on the bike. So with the data I was talking about earlier, the kind of averages in our database of over 100 grams per hour on the bike, but that's on the run kind of sitting around 70 in full distance races. So there is that drop down. It is mainly due to the logistics and the kind of mechanics and how it's harder to take on that same quantity of fuel. But we are seeing that change and that drop off in the top level reduce a little bit. And I think most of that isn't so much to do with what they're consuming. It's about that gut training and that practice and the refining of the process. And Leon, for example, his gut training, as he did over 2 years, that was across the bike and the run and all disciplines. And he built up that tolerance to be able to continue hitting 80, 90 grams per hour on the run. It's more about the practice and the time to be able to consume that.
Yeah, I think going into a race with a stronger plan. Most people go into a triathlon race with a pretty strong plan of what they're going to carry on the bike, but are far more willing to say, well, I'm going to basically pick stuff up at aid stations on the run. And then you're at the mercy of what's available, what brands they have, contents there are. And if you do your homework, you work a lot of those things out, have a reasonably good plan. The stance we generally take with professional athletes, just to control as many controllables as possible. Professionals, it can be different because they have access to pro aid stations quite often, so they can pick up known products like bottles and gels and things en route. But we still encourage them to carry a lot of their gels, a lot of their nutrition on the run, because the firm belief is that being in control and being able to take those when you want them at convenient moments on the course, not feeling stressed every time you come to an aid station, particularly on a multi-lap course where you're going to be bumping into lots of other people, you can kind of cruise by. If you've got your gels in your pocket, you take when you want, you can hit your numbers, you know what you're getting, you know you're familiar with the products. So I think there's a big mind shift organizational thing with that. I remember even I wasn't, as I've already alluded to at the start of this, the best at fueling and hydration when I back in the day when I was racing. But I do remember 1 year racing, I think it was at Half Ironman UK, and knowing that the course was like pretty limited in terms of access to aid stations. One of the aid stations on the run was like kind of pretty fast downhill. And I remember having a look at the course thinking, well, there's no way I'm going to want to be slowing down or stopping. And I carried a fuel belt back then with this solely with the purpose of making myself more efficient, really through the course, thinking that an extra few grams on my waist there I'm going to get that disadvantage back and just being able to keep moving and stay focused on consuming what I've got. So I think that it's all part of that process and everything we've talked about. It's like knowing the numbers you've got to hit, being real about making it practical as to how you're going to have access to what you need, and then being disciplined enough to like follow that plan through. When we all know that, per the Mike Tyson quote, you know, everyone has a plan until they're punched in the face. And in the Ironman, you kind of get, probably you get punched in the gut or the quads face, but you end up on the rug feeling like, I don't want to do this anymore. But when we chat to the pro athletes after the race, they're choking down Jones at mile 18, not really feeling like he, but the message is like, if they're not actually making you feel really sick, if it's not to the point of detriment, of course it's going to be hard to take your nutrition at that point. But if you've got it on you and you can microdose the gel down rather than feeling like you've got to take it all in one go, you're far more likely to keep those energy levels up to the end. You know, it's like the weird thing about nutrition intake in races is nobody goes into a triathlon, I don't believe, expecting it to feel easy physically. But there's this kind of illusion that maybe nutrition has to go perfectly. And it's like, no, it's not going to go perfectly. You're going to get a bit sick of eating this sugary stuff. And as long as it doesn't get to the point where that is fully detrimental to performance, then you do kind of need to keep shoveling it in to an extent and, you know, just putting up with it.
You guys have massively changed the game with the likes of the Flow Gel, which essentially takes away the hassle that majority of athletes in their kitchens cutting 10 gels, squeezing it into a bottle and adding a bit of water. What's your guys' opinion on athletes making their kind of homemade version of that? So gels and then with sachet of electrolytes and topping it up with water. Is there any kind of risk of having such high concentrate? Or actually, as long as they've tried it in training, you're kind of happy that the science suggests that that's good?
Depends on the individual and the mix and the rates and all bits of use like that. I'd say from our case, we've actually seen an increasing trend in athletes doing kind of highly concentrated bottles. But you're absolutely right. If I was talking one-to-one with an athlete, it would be a lot about whether they've tried that before, used it in their training, built up their gut tolerance and bits and pieces like that. But it is a common trend within our case studies.
I think we've softened our stance on it, haven't we? Yeah. If we're honest, we used to be a lot more direct with people saying we thought it was a bad idea. And then we found ourselves making a lot of exceptions because Leon being a fantastic case in point, Leon has one or two highly concentrated bottles, which include most of his carbs, most of his electrolytes, and a little bit of water. And he then picks up water off the course and titrate that strong mix for taking in water. You can't argue with the guy's track record. He's won multiple Ironmans. He's been top 10 in the world 3 times. He's getting it right using that methodology. But it's like, he's also a dedicated, skilled professional who's practiced it a lot. So yeah, I think where our stance has gone to that is like, the rule of thumb is like, if it works, it works. But you have to understand that the reason we have like separated carbs, electrolytes and fluids quite often, or at least certainly separated carbs and fluids and electrolytes and kept them and taught people to keep them separate, is because it de-risks it. And I think as a relative novice athlete or an up and coming age group athlete, that's kind of the apprenticeship, is getting it all basically right with everything a bit separate before you start to navigate your way towards putting it all in one bottle and making it work on the fly, because you need a bit of experience to pull that off.
And it helps with pitting your numbers, right? If you're aiming for a certain amount of fluid and a certain amount of carbohydrates, having that all in one bottle can be quite challenging, and especially when you're racing in different conditions, that's when you can kind of get issues. If you rely solely on strong, concentrated carb drinks that have got electrolytes and everything in there, and it's hot and you need to drink more, and that's all you've got access to, you can really overdo some of the knowledge. You go too high on the carbohydrates. Whereas if you have them a little bit separate and you've got different bottles that you can go towards, depending on if it's hot, then you're going towards more electrolytes and fluid. then it's much easier in those circumstances. So it's good at times to have it split up, especially when you're starting off and starting to build that strategy to help you refine it and hit each, all three of those levers. So the sodium, the fluid and the carbohydrates, it's much easier to have them separate and start.
I would also say it's not a common scenario in the sense it doesn't happen as frequently, but when it does happen, we see more people having problems with races that are unseasonably or extremely cold, because that's a real recipe for underfueling. You just shut down. You don't feel like drinking, for sure, because you probably don't really need to drink a lot if you're in Norseman. Alan Hofter's reported his sweat rate as being close to zero at times, when it's like -5 or wind chill factor. You really don't sweat. So you've got respiratory losses and you've got to replace some fluid, but you've got to have a pretty solid plan to get loads of calories in gels and solid form if it's that cold. Because if you're relying on any liquid calories, you just don't feel like taking them in. And so we've seen a lot of people get tripped up and I suppose it's fair to say both ways, when the race is outside the boundaries of the environment that you're most used to training in, you're most exposed to sort of not understanding how your body's going to feel until it's a bit too late. And so pre-thinking about that and making sure that your carbs, fluids, electrolytes are separated when conditions are quite extreme is a good policy.
I remember that method of the three levers that you spoke of, and that really helped me in my triathlon phase. And I remember every 45 minutes on an Ironman, especially on the bike, I'd ask myself, which lever do I want to pull a little bit more? And usually it was carbs on my end, but to have them separated out really helped, as opposed to just having this kind of diesel that you're just drinking the whole time that you can't separate. And yeah, at some point that can go really wrong. So yeah, separating the levers, I think, is a good starting point.
Yeah, if I can add on there, I think for me, it was the opposite. For me, the lever that was always really important was the electrolyte intake. And as Andy alluded to earlier, a bit of the backstory here, we originally met back in 2014, I think, Andy.
Yeah.
I was at a complete loss as to why my races were falling apart. Even when it wasn't particularly hot, I was in the medical tent with hyponatremia after three of my events in even moderate heat. And it was mind-blowing to me when you said to me, look, come on, I had the in-person sweat test, as was at the time. And I remember you saying to me, like, no one's ever been as high as me on the sweat test. And then you were like, oh, and now you nearly are.
Yeah.
And so for like the extreme case for me, the races, the Ironmans, especially when it was warm, were ending with me, my hands going tingly, feeling sick, passing out, falling over. So for me to learn electrolytes can be the thing that can just completely wreck, or not taking the right amount of electrolytes can be the thing that can completely wreck a race, even when your preparation is fantastic. So I was just wondering if you could explain, for the benefit of the listener, the importance of electrolytes in a long triathlon and how they can get a sort of baseline idea of how much electrolytes they might need per hour. Because again, the baseline recommendation was so much higher than I ever dreamed it would be for most people.
Yep. So very individual in terms of losses. So it's hard to give a certain number of everyone should take this amount of sodium per hour, but it's really important in terms of fluid retention. So when we're sweating, as well as losing water and fluid, we lose electrolytes, in particular sodium being the main one that we all lose in our sweat. But the amount that we all lose in our sweat varies across that range. So you're sitting up at that really high range above 1500 milligrams per liter. There'll be some individuals probably listening who are only sitting around 500 milligrams per liter. So it's really important that you find the amount that works for you. So our online planner can give you an indication. You put in kind of some of the things that link to you about the sweat rate, which we discussed earlier, but also about your sweat sodium. So there are some kind of key indicators that tell you how much, you give you an idea whether you're kind of at that top range. For example, if you get weight marks on your kit, for example, your sweat tastes really salty. But the way to actually determine a number is a sweat test, and we have centers kind of globally that you can find whereabouts there on our website. But the online planner gives you a starting point, an indication, because it also takes into account the conditions that you're going into, your sweat rate, which is obviously a multiplying factor in all of that. If you have a high, if for example you have a high, like Andy, a high sweat sodium concentration and a high sweat rate, then that's the kind of worst combination. For example, your losses can really build up, especially when you're doing these kind of long distance races. aiming to minimize that deficit. So he would need a really proactive strategy and be at that top end of the planner kind of gives an indication of that in terms of how much fluid, how much sodium he would need to replace in his individual losses.
Awesome. So in summary then, we want to get as many people as we can to the online fuel and hydration planner on your website. Now, there's a link to that in the show notes here. Do you just want to talk people through what options are available over on your website, just so everyone's got a really clear idea? Because the amount of stuff that's on there for free, there's as much education as there is products being sold. And I think that's a really great place for people to start.
Yeah, I'd say you're right. The fuel and hydration planner is a really good place to start if you've got a race in mind. You know, if you're sort of building up towards something, that tool is designed so that you can plug in your details about race, details about what the things that you do know about your physiology, and it will give you a reasonable idea of what your race plan should be to the three levers: fluid per hour, sodium per hour, and carbohydrates per hour. So for those who've got a race in mind or are building up towards something, that's a great place to start. If you've got a way more specific question about your kind of personal situation, another great place to start is what's called the Knowledge Hub on the site, and that's keyword search. And we've got loads of blogs, some of which we've kind of touched on details of in this chat, but they've got things like, we've got one about how much dehydration you can tolerate before you perform. So we've got one about cramping, we've got one about the role of electrolytes, we've got one about gut training and how much carbohydrates. So you can cruise around there with some really decent sort of long reads. They're often 2,000, 3,000 word pieces that you can really get your teeth into. Failing that or moving on beyond that, if you've got a highly specific question and you just want to talk to a person about it, you can book a free video call with the sports science team. And these guys do a fantastic job. There are calls a lot of the day now, and we're pretty overwhelmed with calls at times. But you can go onto there, there's a diary system, book a free video call. No one's going to sit there to unsell you anything, or we just want to hear what your issue is that you're dealing with, and we can lend our experience to that and see if we can help guide you in the right direction for an answer. So I would say they're the three major ports of call if you've got a fueling and hydration related question you want to resolve.
Nice one. Right. Well, listen, I think that's a pretty good place to wrap this up, really. I'm going to encourage the listeners to head over and have a look at some of your case studies. I'm hands up. I am a triathlon geek. And if anyone's going to sit and read through different case studies of Leon Chevalier over 15 different races, it is going to be me. But there will be other people out there as well, I think, who find it interesting. So well done you for putting the information together. I think it's going to ultimately help an awful lot of people out. And thank you both very much for coming on the show. Where can people find out more about Precision Fuel and Hydration, please?
I think the best place to start is precisionfuelandhydration.com, or you can just keep it short, go precisionhydration.com. Instagram, we're doing more and more on there, publishing case studies up on the ground as well. So that's Precision FNH. They've been probably the best places to come and find us.
Brilliant stuff. All right. Well, listen, thanks both very much for your time. So listen, guys, just to wrap this show up, here's some discount codes and deals for you. Over at precisionfuelandhydration.com, as you've heard, if you want to try out some products, you can use the code OXYGEN24 for 15% off your first electrolyte order. That genuinely is a word from our sponsors there. And over at teamoxygenaddict.com, I think we've got the most comprehensive endurance sports coaching program for busy age groupers. Book a call with us to see if you'd be a good fit for joining the team, and let's see how we can best help you achieve your endurance event goals for the coming season. So remember, there's links in the show notes. You don't have to remember them. Till next week, have a great, safe training and racing week. I'm Coach Rob Wilby, and you've been listening to the Oxygen Addict Podcast.